Day one of the Isle of Man government conference, while light on major policy announcements and big reveals, was very engaging and well put together. Our government, like governments around the world, faces significant economic and demographic challenges, but is our government ready to meet these challenges? We'll hear first from Treasury Minister Alex Allenson.
You gave an upbeat presentation, which is what we would expect from the Treasury Minister.
Well, it was honest as well, because what we've had is a presentation in terms of the world environment and particularly problems with inflation and prices, but also government debt and demographic changes, and then trying to put those in an Isle of Man perspective. And I remain optimistic about the Isle of Man. There's so many good qualities, both of the people and the country itself. I think they have got us through some hard times recently. They will get us through any current threats and further threats. But actually, there's a huge amount of opportunity here for our people and for the business sector here as well.
Well, let's talk about the opportunities then. One thing that seems reasonably clear is that you were describing the fact that our inflation rates mirror UK inflation rates generally, and UK inflation is primarily being driven by food prices. You mentioned that we could invest in food security. What did you mean by that?
Well, we import a huge amount of our food, and what we've seen is that surges in energy prices have had knock-on effects in terms of transport, in terms of farming. We know that happens. One of the things that DEFRA have been really keen on trying to do is get people to buy local, get people to support the local economy so we don't have to import as much. And so though all those plans are already there, not just for food security and making sure that people have food on their plate, but also to encourage a more diverse agricultural sector as well. And also try to enable younger people to come into the farming industry, many of whom are put off at the moment by the costs and the barriers to that. So again, for a small island nation, we can do that. We can also look at our fisheries. We can look at all these various aspects that have done us proud in the past that perhaps have been neglected because of the rise in terms of financial services. But they are an inherent part of the Isle of Man and something that really needs to be cherished and encouraged.
Obviously, you say these things, but one of the major things in terms of the Manx food sector that happened during this government was the closure of Ramsay Bakery. Now, okay, you can't force a company to carry on running, but you could have alternatives in place, or indeed support alternatives when they're suggested to you.
And we've seen that. So Ramsay Bakery closed. It was privately run. It was done for family reasons inherently. But what we've seen since then is we've had new artisan bakeries starting up. We've also seen some more large-scale bakeries opening up. We've also seen Tesco's coming in and substituting some of the imports for locally baked products. But inherently, what we've seen is the stability in terms of the flour mills. We've seen that supporting local producers. We've seen various bakeries actually upscaling and dealing with some of the niche markets that they've got. When you look at what happened before Ramsay Bakery, there was actually lots of smaller independent bakeries. Since that's gone, a lot of those have come back again. And things change. People's tastes change, but also the business model changes. And again, it's dealing with that change and trying to manage it is the responsibility of government.
Energy security, then, I guess, is something that, well, it should be relatively easy to crack.
Actually, it's one of the hardest things to crack, because we've got this conflict between people wanting low prices but always the lights on. When you look at what used to happen before we transitioned to natural gas in terms of previous power generation, which was coal and then oil, there were constant issues with the reliability. Very rarely do Manx utilities have to do power cuts nowadays, and normally it's to do with storms. So we've got that reliability, but that comes at a cost. And again, in terms of energy security, what we have is huge backup facilities on the Isle of Man in terms of gas production, interconnectors, diesel generation, should those two run into difficulties. That comes at a cost, but actually is of an inherent value, both for our economy and also for people who want to be able to turn the lights on and cook their meals. And you only have to look at other nations, particularly places like South Africa, which have rolling power cuts now because of the lack of previous investment in the infrastructure, to see what happens if you don't keep abreast of these changes.
Some might argue argue that the rolling power cuts might encourage the birth rate?
Actually, when you look at what encourages birth rates, it tends to be big football games and football matches such as the World Cup and the Euros. I mean, that was one of the things we were talking about today, is the demographic changes, not just on the Isle of Man, but across the Western world. And that's driven by a whole range of things. It's driven by people wanting to develop careers, go into tertiary education, but also the cost of having a family and the financial barriers to having more than one or two children. What this government have done is really trying to have a family-focused policy. That's why we've invested in the childcare strategy, why we've provided more childcare, affordable and accessible childcare, why we've changed child benefit to equalise it for second and subsequent children, why we've looked at the thresholds for child benefit as well. So trying to make sure that we can provide the right environment by also investing in healthcare and education. But going forward, also looking at things like increases in the minimum wage, making sure that everyone on the island shares the benefits of economic growth.
So many people, so many young people, and it tends to be young people that have children, say that one of the main reasons that they don't is, quite frankly, they can't afford to do it. They can't afford housing, the sort of housing that they would need for a family, and they really struggle to make the maths work.
Yeah, and that's always been an issue. It's never been easy to start a family, but it's got harder. And part of that is the increase in house prices on the Isle of Man, and that we haven't been building enough houses to meet the needs of future generations. What we've had announced today at the government conference by the Chief Minister is a complete review of first-time buyers, looking at the income thresholds, looking at the ability for people to get government support to get on the housing ladder if they want to buy. But also we must look at the private rental sector as well, for those families who don't qualify for social housing, to make sure that they can get a roof over their heads and security of tenure as well, so that they can plan ahead. Because it is difficult, it always has been, but what we need to do is give people that helping hand to allow them to make the right choices for themselves and their families.
Has government failed, would you say, in relation to solving the housing crisis?
I think we've had a successive failure to grasp the nettle that we need to build more houses, we need to reform the planning controls going back decades to provide the right amount of houses for the people who are staying on the island. The way of dealing with that, though, is by working with local communities. So we would prefer to do brownfield site development first rather than greenfield site. And you, in your previous jobs, have probably gone through all sorts of issues with planning, that everyone says they want more houses, but they don't necessarily want to have to look at them. We need to break that and have a more sustainable way of providing housing on the island, which is why this administration had the OHAN, the Objective Assessment of Housing Need. So we've now got the ability to actually bring that into things like the strategic plan that's under consultation at the moment, to make sure we get the right sort of housing, the right areas, to benefit all people, whether that's young people starting families or older people who want to downsize in terms of their retirement.
When I do these interviews with ministers, I get the feeling that ministers would be willing to be bolder in terms of their policies. But of course, you operate in a collective, and that Council of Ministers collective seems to be... Well, I mean, I suppose it's always been a kind of a leveller when it comes to bold policies. You know, you end up with the kind of lowest common denominator, the thing that everyone can agree to in council of ministers is what ends up getting done. So you don't get that boldness in terms of policy making.
But isn't that democracy? I mean, I'd also say you're laying the blame on the Council of Ministers saying we're not bold enough. I think this administration has come through with a huge amount of opportunities in terms of economic policy, the island plan. People have argued against it. So it's not the status quo. But what we've also got is getting things through Timwald. So, for instance, you know, this time last year, I was talking to Timwald about the triple lock and the sustainability of the National Insurance Fund. Timwald were reticent to change that, and that was seen as being bold. old being too far, more consultation, more discussion, more debate. We live in a democracy, Phil, and I respect that. But sometimes that can limit the powers of a government to do things, sometimes rightly so. Sometimes that can hinder. But good ideas never die. They just sometimes take slightly longer to come to fruition than they should do.
Financial literacy was a question that was asked that maybe we should be doing more in schools to help children understand how money works. Do you think perhaps if that had happened 20, 30 years ago, it might have been easier for, well, Isle of Man government specifically, but governments around the world to explain the dire financial positions that face public finances?
Well, again, that's public finances. What we were talking about was financial literacy being taught at school so people could deal with their own personal finances, saving for deposits on housing, those sort of things. What I would say is a lot of young people are incredibly clever in terms of dealing with things like online banking, transferring money. If they go out for a meal, they'll transfer money between each other on their phones. That financial literacy now and the ability to deal with real-time data on how much money they've got in the bank account is in the palm of their hand. And I think that's transformed some of the previous teaching. I gave the story about being given a piggy bank previously when I was about 8 years old. I think people have matured since then and are adopting new technologies, online banking, all those sort of things. And that gives them a lot more education going through the financial services sector and government working with the financial services sector to expand that with some of the apprenticeship schemes we've seen and some of the teaching that's provided in schools now.
You were asked by one questioner what plans you have, or did you agree that your plans for tax increases were going to impact on the poorest paid in society? You seemed a little surprised because you claim that you aren't going to make any tax increases.
I made quite clear at this year's budget and last year's budget that we needed to raise extra revenue, particularly to fund quite significant expansions in terms of education and healthcare. We've gone through the pain of that, of increasing taxation at the higher rate from 20 to 22% and then reduced it down to 21%. We've also looked at the various thresholds for things like taxation in terms of personal allowances and a commitment to increase that, but also looking at national insurance, the national insurance funds and its long-term sustainability. I have no plans to increase taxation, but what we do need to do, and I think it would be made quite clear from all the conversations we've had with the population, is make sure we are delivering value for money for the taxpayer. And that's why there's been an absolute commitment to looking at efficiency, savings within the public sector, looking at making sure that those services we provide as a government are done in exactly the right way, have the right outcomes, but are done in the most efficient and cost-effective way. So we are looking at the budgets, we are reducing in real terms government budgets, at the same time as trying to maintain those services. That's not an easy thing to do, but we need to make sure, and we had lots of conversations this morning about consumer confidence, about people being able to go out more, enjoy our nation more, use the hospitality sector, buy things, do things, eat out, drink out, enjoy what we have on our island. And the only way of doing that is by making sure people have more money in their pockets and have the confidence to spend it.
So the health levy, that's dead in the water, is it?
That I'll be announcing the results of that. We had 3,800 people contributing to that. Vast majority of people saw that there needed to be extra investment in health, but actually said what they wanted was for government to get its own house in order first and make sure it's providing as efficient and cost-effective services as possible. That's what we've been doing this last year. That's what this time last year the Chief Minister announced, the savings programme of trying to make sure we could drive value for money for the Isle of Man taxpayer. That's what we'll be continuing to do.
Because that health levy certainly looked on paper to be an income tax rise, but called a health levy.
The idea of having ring-fenced extra revenue for healthcare is not something that's new. We've been talking a lot at the government conference so far about the worldwide stresses in terms of public expenditure, particularly on health, but also for education on our island, and how you deal with that while still preserving some of the ethos of the National Health Service, which I think most people hold quite dear on our island.
So it must come as a disappointment to you that despite the significant increase in budget and the contingency that's made available, the first quarter report that's come through shows health overspend. Maybe not a surprise, but a disappointment.
What Treasury have been doing with all the departments is sitting down on a regular basis going through the stresses they're under. We've done exactly the same with the Department of Health and Social Care and with Manx Care itself, with the board, having regular meetings, understanding where the pressures are, trying to help them deal with those, particularly because this year we've had an announcement from the Minister that there will be a reform of the way that healthcare is funded, in terms of that funding going into primary care, that money going into GP services, dental services, reducing waiting lists in CAMHS, trying to deal with that first initial contact people have with the NHS rather than wait until they get seriously unwell and end up in nobles or being flown across to the adjacent aisle. So I think it's absolutely right that we work with these areas rather than have quite stringent austerity measures which cut back on services and outcomes for our people. The whole idea of investment in our healthcare service and Manx Care was to drive quality and patient safety. I think that's improved dramatically, but it comes at a cost. Now what we have to do is balance that in terms of the income we generate as a government.
And in terms of the other departments, I think there were three other departments that were mentioned as being overspent. I mean, is that partly a case of they've kind of spent a bit more in the first quarter than they might, but there's clear slack in the system to make the savings at a later stage in the financial year?
Yeah. I mean, what we've done is have quarterly reports about real-time spending. This is the first time that's ever been done. Normally, you wait until the end of the year and then say, oh, sorry, we've overspent and gone for a supplementary bid. We're now working with all departments that where we can focus on a particular stress, deal with that, mitigate it early rather than wait until it gets out of control. So for instance, you know, education have had pressures in terms of extra staff for children with additional educational needs. The Department of Home Affairs have had stresses in terms of some of their forensic costs and also dealing with a number of incidents on our island which have led to police overtime. We appreciate that, and so it's then trying to see whether that is genuinely extra funding that needs to come from contingency, or whether over the course of the rest of the year they can claw back some of that by adjusting their other activities. But it's that ability for the public to see in real time how we're doing, I think, is incredibly important in terms of the scrutiny of public finances going forward, and it's part of our democracy.
There are some positives, certainly in your presentation. There were quite a few. One is that tax take seems to be higher than expected.
Yes, I mean, what we've been doing is tracking the increased amount of income tax being raised. Some of that's due to bonuses, some of that's due to increased pay, some of that's due to increased earnings people have on interest they've got in, you know, from bank accounts, from savings. How much of that is sustainable in the long term, given that the uncertainty we have in the world community is very unclear at the moment? We're trying to get far better projections by analysing the data. What we are committed to, though, is not taking that for granted. We can't keep on spending everything we get in. We need to make sure that people have more money in their pockets, they can spend more in our community, they can actually encourage our economy. But at the same time, we have to reduce the real-time cost of government and put money back into reserves. And so one of the issues in terms of the quarterly accounts was the ambition to put back the interest from the reserves back into the reserves to grow them. And they have been growing up to £1.96 billion now, but we need to replenish those reserves after a number of years of black swan events where we've had to draw down on them to in a considerable extent.
You introduced a new word to me during your presentation, a quadlemma. You were talking about energy. Explain to the listener what a quadlemma is.
Well, Manx Utilities used to have the trilemma of energy security, energy price, and also resilience, so that the lights would stay on, whatever happened, but it was at a price that was affordable. Added to that now, we have the whole idea of climate change and that sustainability, which can add extra costs. But also in the long term, when you look at the costs of production, actually things like solar panels, wind farms, those are an efficient way of creating electricity. Now, I know that there's controversy about them, and I understand that, but looking to the future, are we going to build more gas-fired power stations, or are we going to be using far more renewables? But key to that is investing in the infrastructure of the island, whether that be energy production, whether that be energy efficiency, or whether that be our roads and our schools and our hospitals. And that's where government and the capital programme comes in, but also working with Manx Utilities to balance the need to generate extra electricity through sustainable ways at the right cost for the consumer.
Do you think politicians, maybe political commentators, need to be a little bit more honest with the public in that, bearing in mind the scale of the financial dilemmas, particularly the issue in terms of how do we afford to pay for people in their old age, whether that be health, retirement, or any of the other benefits that pensioners get. That's a massive problem. It's a problem across the world. We've got falling birth rates as well, which just exacerbate the problem. Do you think we need to be more honest in having that conversation with the public and explaining that actually, you know what, because of these pressures, don't expect lots of magic money trees to pop up in an election year?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have been fairly honest with people. We had a big debate in Tynwald last year and again in January about the National Insurance Fund, about that we know that if we do nothing, it's unsustainable. So what can we do to solve that? And we talked about retirement age, we talked about triple lock, we talked about all these aspects. So we have started those discussions, but they're difficult discussions to make. And it's getting some of that intergenerational fairness between a young person who wants to start out getting a home and getting it for a decent price, and an older person who wants to sell their home for a decent price so they can afford to downsize into a nice retirement home or a bungalow. It's trying to get that fairness right across the piece. I think the reality is that change is essential, change is necessary. The Isle of Man has always changed to adapt to new circumstances, whether that be threats from wherever or opportunities from those same places. We are in that transition now in an incredibly uncertain world, and it's absolutely right that we have those honest discussions with people about the need for change and the benefits that will bring for our island community.
Would your job be easier, do you think, if Tynwald was a little more collegiate in its approach?
No. My job, just to get things done, would be, but would it be the right things? We need that democratic challenge. We need that democratic debate, because it is key when you manage change that we take people along with us, whether that be climate change, whether that be economic change, whether that be fiscal policies. We need to explain why we're doing things. People might not like it, but as long as they understand the reasons for it and understand that it's been done in the right way for long-term prosperity for our island rather than short-term political gain, then I can go to bed happy.
That was Ramsay MHK Alex Allenson. HSBC global economist James Pomeroy placed the Isle of Man in the global context.
So I think if you step back from the sort of short-term economic noise, there's a lot of things to think about the future. Which sectors of the global economy are going to do well that the Isle of Man can really benefit from? And for me, they fall into three main categories. There's thinking about clean energy, both the investment and then the second round benefits from that investment. There's huge opportunities around technology, so around AI, but also other technologies, digitized global economy. And then there's a third story about people. And there's a challenge on that front, which is aging populations and the strains that creates on fiscal positions. But there's also an upside risk here, which is thinking about where the consumers of the future are. And so many of those people are going to be in Southeast Asia, emerging middle class consumers. They're going to be the consumers of the future for all of European goods, including produced here in the Isle of Man, and services, of course, as well. And that includes things like tourism, a part of the economy globally that we see is structurally strong and growing very quickly today.
The obvious thing that everyone seems to know about, but no one seems to have an answer to, is the fact that there are fewer and fewer people in work as a proportion of those who are out of work, And I think you have a new policy suggestion.
I do. I mean, it's not very popular, but when you look at the ageing population challenge across most of the Western world, you've really got a situation where the number of pensioners is rising by about 1.5 to 2% per year. And you think about what that does in terms of pension costs, healthcare costs, social care costs, it's pretty unsustainable at a time where the number of workers per pensioner is falling and falling and falling. So I think you've got to make some tough decisions, and governments across the world have got to seriously think about raising retirement ages. Now, not by a year or two, I think substantially north of 70, 72, 73, those sorts of numbers are our sort of base case of where retirement ages need to get to. But you add on top of that questions about how healthcare is funded, how social care is funded, whether pensions should be means tested in one way or another. These are questions I think more and more government ministers, both here and in the UK and across Europe, are going to have to think a lot more about.
A number of people will say, well, you can't possibly expect everyone to work to 72, but maybe the governments around the world need to start thinking about things that would make it more attractive for people to perhaps do part-time work as they ease into retirement.
That's it. There's a number of different ways this is easier today than it ever has been, partly because of the nature of work. You know, this is very, very hard to have a high retirement age when you're doing a lot of physical labour, be that agriculture or manufacturing. But actually, in most economies in the developed world now, most work that people do is some sort of services that you can do until you're 70 or older. And many people do. And there is a question, as you say, about actually, could we make this a part-time thing? Could you ease people into it? Are there certain jobs that are going to be better suited for people with that experience? It's also worth noting, in these professional services jobs, people when they're in their 60s or 70s are hugely valuable to the population. And actually taking them out, that experience, that expertise out of the economy has almost a double whammy effect. You're taking away those earnings and that sort of consumption that comes from those earnings, and you're losing that expertise out of the population, and that is a challenge as well. So anything we can do to keep people in work a little bit longer would be good for public finances, and it'd be good for the economy.
And of course, private sector pensions, if you don't take your pension at 65, you get more of a pension that the longer you wait.
Exactly. There's incentives to do that as well. And you sort of have a higher quality of life each year with that income that is coming. So again, there's opportunities there. It's also worth noting that for people retiring today, broadly across the world, this is true, that the level of wealth is quite high. Now, actually, when you think about what's happened to asset prices, so homes or equity prices in pensions, those prices have gone up extraordinarily over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. So actually the ability to think about, okay, do I need some of that extra estate provision and so forth is clearly there. But the problem is that's allowing people to retire earlier. So actually what we're seeing post-pandemic is a lot of people retiring in their 50s rather than their 60s or 70s. Now, they're not necessarily getting a state pension, but we're still losing that expertise in the population. So there's a number of ups and downs that happen as a result of all of these things. But broadly, we are in a world where, sadly, for most fiscal positions to become, or to at least stay relatively sustainable, we're going to need higher retirement ages.
The one thing that I noted that you mentioned was the fact that the Isle of Man government has relatively low debt is a positive.
Certainly. And if you look across the world and you look at the fiscal strains that governments are facing, it's partly because of these demographic challenges, but it's also historical levels of debt that means you've got enormous interest bills to pay. So having low levels of debt gives you a little bit more freedom, a little bit more flexibility, more levers that you can pull rather than being sort of forced into spending more and more money every single year on interest payments as well as these other things. So that's an opportunity for the Isle of Man, both in terms of spending, but also in terms of attracting international investment, because the fiscal position should be more sustainable than many other peers locally, but both in Europe and across the world.
And I presume there must be advantages for being a relatively small country like the Isle of Man is. What advantages do you think we would have over the much larger countries?
It allows policy setting to be more nimble. It allows you to adapt more quickly. It allows substantial change to maybe be pushed through and explained to an electorate more readily. It allows those big structural things to happen. Whereas in larger economies with a larger voting base, it's much, much harder to get sustainable change through. And that's actually a huge opportunity in a world where the global economy is changing so quickly, both on that demographic challenge, but also these other sectors that are growing so quickly. It's much easier to pivot into these fast-growing economies if you're a smaller, more nimble, more dynamic economy, which the Isle of Man certainly is, and that's an opportunity that's really got to be harnessed in the coming years.
one of the questions that was put to the panel earlier was that maybe we need to teach children a little bit more about how to manage personal finances.
Yeah.
Do you think perhaps if we did that, we wouldn't have the situation which certainly the UK government is facing? It's happening in France as well, where people are unwilling to accept the reality that there has to be a change, possibly for the worse, in terms of extended working life, perhaps reduced services, that these things have to happen because, quite frankly, there isn't enough money to pay for them all.
Exactly. I think there's two parts to that. There's partly sort of managing your personal finances, but there's also that broader question about understanding the economy. Now, where do your taxes go? What do those services provide? How sustainable are they? How do you get a pension? How much does that cost? These things are really important. I'm just saying this because I'm an economist, but I think understanding the basics of macroeconomics would really help the sort of broader economy. It'd allow governments to maybe make it a little bit easier to make these changes. Now, I find when I talk about these demographic issues, the amount of people who never really have thought about it, and then you show them these terrifying charts and they go, well, hang on, yeah, he's right. That is concerning. Maybe we do need to adapt, maybe we do need to change. But that's only part of the story. People may know that change needs to happen, but whether you can get that through or they want it is a different thing entirely. But at least certainly getting that macroeconomic, microeconomic and personal finance education up will allow us, hopefully, to make more of these changes.
And of course, all this would be bad as it is, assuming that we continue to have the same level of birth rates that, we have recruitment into our potential workforce, as well as the significant increase in people wanting to retire. But of course, birth rates are falling as well. And predictions now from I don't know, what do they call them, population geographists, that we're going to see substantial reductions in population.
Yeah, and that's a huge problem. You look at birth rates across the world, they're all falling. So globally, birth rates are down about 3.5% a year over the last 5 years. So since the pandemic, we've seen this really sharp drop. And it's a number of factors driving that. And it's almost universal across the world. It's social factors, started with more female participation in the workforce, which is a great thing in terms of social equality, in terms of the economy. But it has meant people now starting to have children later in life. And then you're getting this little thing as well amongst couples of saying, you know what? We want to make sure we've got enough money. We want to make sure we've got it. We've lived our lives, or we've done the travel we want to do. Then we'll start a family. So you're seeing naturally people starting to have children slightly later. But there's also a huge economic cost here. You've got to think about the cost of housing, the cost of childcare, the average incomes of young people today relative to all of those things. Having a family is just not affordable for a lot of young people. That's not just a story in the Isle of Man. It's not just a story in the UK. It's a story across the Western world, across the developed world. And birth rates keep falling. And we say, actually, you look at somewhere like South Korea, where the birth rate is 0.7 children per woman. That means that over a generation, the population drops by 2/3. Well, all the things that have caused that to happen, they're happening everywhere else across the world. And we get some super detailed data in the UK by city. And Brighton, the city near where I live, has got a birth rate lower than China today. And you sort of think, well, why wouldn't that happen across other cities, other areas of the UK? Here in the Isle of Man, certainly can. And that continued decline in birth rates makes those fiscal problems not necessarily worse tomorrow, but it makes them much, much worse in 20 years' time. And it hurts economic growth. It hurts the number of people that you can employ. It's a really, really big challenge. But it's one that gets worse and worse and worse every year, as long as these birth rates are staying low.
One thing that the listener won't have noticed is that all the way through this interview you've been smiling, which is nice, but how do you smile when there's all this really quite gloomy news that you've got to impart?
Yeah, there's loads and loads of reasons to be pessimistic about the world. The way I like to think about it is, if you take the last 5 years, over the last 5 years, we've had a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, we've had wars, we've had supply chain crises, we've had high inflation, we've had interest rates going up really, really quickly. And yet, everything's sort of okay. It may not feel amazing, but a lot of people have jobs. Unemployment rates are super low. Incomes are picking up. actually, if that's what's happened in all of those horrendous things that have happened in the last 5 years, what happens if in the next 5 years none of those bad things happen? And yes, these demographic problems are an enormous fiscal burden, but there's a lot of other good things happening in the economy around technological investment, clean energy, areas of the economy that are growing that will create jobs, that will create investment. That, I think, is a really big opportunity. So despite all the doom and gloom, there's also some reasons for optimism.
That was HSBC global economist James Pomeroy. Former MHK Chris Robertshaw was one of several who took the opportunity to question the speakers.
It's fair to say that you've been a bit grumpy with some of the panellists this morning.
You said you weren't going to accuse me of being grumpy, but no, actually that's probably true. I mean, there were two sections this morning, the financial element and the connectivity element, and I think I've got justification in being grumpy. I thought that Dr. Allinson was his usual doctor in practice, trying to assure everybody that everything was all right when, in fact, we know it's not.
But Treasury ministers have to, don't they?
Well, they have to deal with the realities, and the realities now is that our low paid are being overtaxed, and that there's a real challenge there to keep our tax competitive nature and to be fair to our low paid. And then moving to the second part of the morning on connectivity, I don't think anybody who knows me was surprised that I challenged the chairman of the steam packet about their low occupancy in the passenger seats of that lovely new boat, and that they weren't dealing with yield management. And I was really concerned in their presentation, and Brian Thompson's presentation, that they saw all, and this is really interesting, they saw all ticket price reductions as a cost. I said, no, that's a revenue opportunity. And if they adopted proper yield management approach to things, A, they'd see lots more seats filled, and yes, they'd make more money. But they just don't get it.
Isn't that, though, just semantics? I mean, perhaps it was just a really poorly designed slide, because certainly the chair of the Isle of Man steam packet said, well, no, we do get this. We do understand about how actually growing markets through these initiatives is a positive thing. And they have, to be fair on them, done this in relation to the Kids Go Free deal, which has resulted in an increase in passengers.
Yes, fine, but they presented it. They presented what actions they have taken as a cost. And once I became aware of their lack of understanding of yield management, I also challenged the single shareholder outside of today and outside of other meetings to see, well, what was their position? And Treasury's position was, well, hang on, we need these ticket prices because we need to pay for a new boat and we need to pay for Liverpool landing stage. But if they adopted, sorry to repeat myself, if they adopted more sophisticated yield management concepts, then their revenue would go up, not down. And I'm astonished they don't get that. There's no real commerciality in the way the steam packet's been run. It's almost been run as an extension of the Treasury. There needs to be some thinking there.
There were some positives, though, weren't there, this morning? I mean, income tax looks as though it's going to be ahead of where the budget had predicted it to be. The health overspend isn't as bad as it's been in previous years, but yeah, of course, we've had that the extra money put in. But generally speaking, some of the positives that the Treasury Minister was talking about, relatively low unemployment rates in the island, things are starting to recover now after COVID. Even a hard-hearted cynic like yourself would have to acknowledge that things aren't as bad as they could be.
I didn't know you were such a kind soul, Phil. Well done for that. I congratulate you. Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, at the same time as saying those things, they were saying, oh, well, here's our proposed savings. And they were talking about, I don't know, 7.5 to 10 million per year. And I think my point at that particular stage was, well, here we are, you're in your last year in office, and you're still proposing savings. We haven't seen any yet. Why should we believe you now when all the other good things you've said would happen haven't actually happened? No, we still, and some of the, most of the increase in revenue is to do with adjusting certain areas where money has been put aside to protect possible expenses, which didn't materialise. And the other one was a significant return on increase in income tax, related to the fact that now what we're seeing washing into our system, now that there are reasonable interest rates, remember we've gone through 10 years of almost nothing, we're seeing taxation on that interest. So, but I think what you need to do is also look at the cost side of government, which was escalated massively in terms of wages and salaries and other expenses. And I believe the people of the Isle of Man will be much more confident if they can see at some point soon the government recognise the fact that it's got to run more efficiently and more productively and keep its costs under control and stop blaming healthcare, which is part of the problem, for all of it and hiding behind, oh, well, that's the problem. It's much more than that.
That was Chris Robertshaw. Finally, Chief Minister Alf Cannon.
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in this year's conference, as you can probably gauge from the main hall, we've been almost full to capacity. And in fact, we've had to set up a side room, which has been televising out the stage and the panels that have been taking part. So I'm pleased in terms of the attendance at the conference and the engagement that's being shown from everybody.
And there is a great opportunity for people to ask questions. I think half-hour sessions, aren't they? They're certainly filled with interesting questions.
Yeah, which is good. I mean, that's always, clearly a part of the main attraction of this type of conference, is that engagement piece, allowing us to interact properly with the audience and allowing them their say as well. And it hasn't just been questions. I think some people have tried to make quite clear points which have required them to speak for a bit longer. So, that allowance is critical. This was always supposed to be a two-way engagement. From what I've seen, it's been working pretty well.
Presumably that is the point of this conference, isn't it? It is primarily for you to give people an opportunity to talk to you, to hear what's going on and to give feedback.
Yeah, I think we set this up, and I set this up really to try and drive that interaction, to give a much more open forum for government, I think, to talk about what it's been doing, but more importantly, highlight what it's going to be doing over the next 12 months. And I hope we've gone some way to achieving that in both the speeches that have been given, but also in the panel discussions that are taking place, and also for people to walk away with concepts and views and understanding, not just from panelists and those involved, but also from the audience members who quite often are coming up with very reasoned, clear arguments as to why government should take certain policy directions. And that whole sort of thought leadership piece in terms of engagement, understanding, recognising where people have strong views or good evidenced views about policies that government should implement is very important.
It's another kind of aim of this conference to try and get, I don't know, a little bit more excitement into politics. People can actually come, they can turn up to the hotel here, and they get to see all the people who effectively run the Isle of Man.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is certainly, obviously, about that activity, the engagement, the conversations, the environment that's created in this sort of space, but it's also a desire to partly highlight the problems that the government is seeking to address, what is causing some of the issues that we see in terms of the policy directions that we're having To take. So, for example, this morning I'm going to think the piece by the international economist, HSBC's economist James Pomeroy, was, I hope, laid foundations for people in terms of not just the island's challenges, but the global challenges that are reflected on the island and the problems that everybody is having in terms of tackling some of those issues. So, yeah, so I hope that partly it's education, partly it's engagement, partly it's opportunity, you know, for scrutiny and challenge.
And one of the things that the economist did say was that it is very, very difficult for governments all around the world to actually do the right thing, because when you are in government, you have lots and lots of people in opposition who are all saying, actually, you know what, we could do this better, we would make things an awful lot easier, we would sort all these problems out overnight, which then makes it difficult for the people in power to make the right decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very true. I think Mr. Pomeroy was pretty clear in the reasons behind some of that, the demographic challenges. I mean, we've been talking about this for 4 years now, but I think he was very crystal clear on what is happening and materializing around the world with that demographic issue, the rising cost of healthcare, the impact of tariffs in America, and the knock-on impact that we're likely to see here in the UK. And in, by extension, on into the Isle of Man as well, the challenges around inflation and pricing. So, absolutely, you know, we're all under a huge amount of pressure. I think governments, not just on the Isle of Man, but you know, we can see it clearly around the globe. And yeah, tackling some of these issues, that some of which are in our control and many of which are not, you know, are difficult, challenging. And, of course, it does cause a sense of frustration. But I think the purpose of today was to try and raise that level of conversation, set the scene around those critical challenges, hear that independent voice, that independent economic voice. And then, obviously, I think you can take that and then reflect that locally in terms of understanding what the government's doing and perhaps an understanding of some of the critical issues that are facing us all.
The system, the political system that we operate in the Isle of Man, though, means that it is difficult for governments to be bold. And clearly every politician wants to be able to announce bold policies and big initiatives. But effectively, you in Council of Ministers and indeed in Tynwald have a range of competing views, and you end up kind of negotiating into the middle ground, which tends not to be bold and maybe not as exciting as perhaps people might be looking for in their politics.
True. You're probably drawing me into a broader conversation about the makeup of our political system, but I think what you say is essentially true. And I think but that's been the case for a very long time. I mean, I think we are in an environment where perhaps slightly more radical, if that's the right word, or stronger policies in some areas might address some of the situation. I mean, I think this issue for many of us at the moment is about creating some wealth for families and for individuals, putting some money back in people's pockets. And as Mr. Pomeroy said, clearly if people were spending more, then we would actually see a bit more active growth in our economy. And of course, many families are feeling squeezed for a number of reasons, and of course inflation isn't going away. But yeah, I mean, you know, but on the other hand, Phil, we've been incredibly stable. I know there's been some ups and downs, and I've had a no confidence challenge, but we're still offering a great deal of stability. I think, you know, when you compare us to other nations which are swapping governments and leaders almost you know, annually at the moment, I've lost count of the number of senior ministers and prime ministers that have been come and gone since I took office, never mind in the last 10 years. But still not really any further forward despite all those changes. And of course, what you're finding is that people are inheriting, you know, the same set of problems. The reality of those problems needs a lot more nuancing and clever thinking than, you know, big, bold statements that actually, in reality, just don't work.
It'd be quite fun, though, wouldn't it, if you could be the Donald Trump of Manx politics?
Well, you know, you would love to have that sort of remit, you know, to be able to perhaps at times do things that you want to do in your way. But, you know, you also have a responsibility to work, you know, across the island with the political makeup of everybody that's been put in a democratic mandate, you know, by everybody else in other constituencies. And yes, it's my job is to try and bring that together, try and force some of the pace at which we are addressing some of the issues. But yeah, you hold a collegiate, a necessary requirement to be very collegiate and to try and pull things together. But you also have to, you know, accept, as you can clearly see, that there are different dynamics, different political forces at play in terms of individuals' leanings. And I guess, you know, that is perhaps the downside of not having a party system. But having said that, of course, you know, has the party system actually working in other democracies? I have to leave that to your listeners to decide that.
That was Aaron Michael, MHK, Alf Cannon. So what do you think? Would you be willing to keep working to 72 to help us all out of the growing imbalance between working population and dependents? Is it a bit late in the day for government to be starting to deliver real savings in government expenditure? Or do you applaud the government for finally taking action? Lots to consider from this week's show. Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. I'm Phil Gorn, Goramayos and Geisha from. Thanks for listening.